for?
So while we wait for questions to come in, Tony, if you could, I know that there are some people who I encourage to join this call today to kind of give them an update on the latest SBA tech issue. You know, we probably don't need as much detail as you and I discussed yesterday, but just sort of a general overview, just so that we can and all the reps can explain to borrowers just that there might be some delays here on that time frame, and we're of course going to update all of the applicants already in process, but it might be good just for everybody to know that. So could you just kind of walk through the latest with the SBA tech issue that is now being resolved?
Sure, thanks. So even though this is, I mean, this is an SBA product, just so everybody knows. It is an SBA product, but we are not selling SBA. However, a lot of our verification, a lot of the verification itself has to be done according to SBA standards, because they are still, eventually they're still going to be giving the money for the actual loan, paying it back at least to the CDFIs that do the loan. Long story short is that there has been a lot of fraud on this particular, in not only within the syndicated program, but across this SBA chasm with PPP and EIDL. So they found that there was groups that took advantage of the system, and they got away with about maybe 90, well, as of today, it was about $117 million of funds that they're unable to get back. So what the system decided to do, or what the system was designed to do at that point, was use the IP addresses that individuals are applying from as a way to verify if the actual individuals are viable or not. that being said, all iPhones have the same IP address. And there are a lot of similarities between IP addresses depending on the network that you are. So, you know, if everybody's on Xfinity, then you know, the IP address might change within a couple of numbers. They started to systematically deny certain loans based off of the IP address, believing that if there were similar IP addresses, then it had to have been fraud. So a lot of the about 17 million loans within a four-week span were denied because of an IP address, believing that it was fraud. A couple of us raised you know, all types of mess about that situation, because it's not right, obviously. And so they've been having meetings the last couple of days, and so they're overturning all of these IP address issues to either automatic approval, or they need more information. Information that we already asked for, which is, you know, the articles of incorporation, their driver's license, void a check in order for them to be able to process it. We knew that going in, which is why we needed to, we were asking for those, for that information to begin with. So at this point, they are officially fixing the problem and turning over all of these particular denials that were strictly because of IP. They may be denied again. This was a conversation that I was on prior to this. They may be denied again for other reasons, but if it was IP, they're going to be flipping them. And then we'll be able to do that. That being said, because there's a very limited amount of individuals that are actually doing these loans, the extension has been from a firm 15 days to now 15 to 30 days turn time that we are expecting from application to funding is going to be about 30 days. So that's really what the SBA has been doing, because we need to use their verification system in order for us to obviously verify if the individual applied for EIDL or not, and they're also doing their verification system to verify the identity. So we apologize, and we appreciate your patience on this, but we'll get it done. So if you get an email or if you get notification from one of the processors saying, okay, this was denied because of an IP address issue, there's a chance that it might be reversed and then continue on with the process. But just so everybody knows, it might be, if they are denied again, it's for another reason, but not for this particular reason that everybody is aware of.
Awesome. Thank you, Tony, for that. And so, yeah, so I would just say and echo what you just said to everybody on this call. When you're talking about the Express program, I know some of the marketing material says, you know, 10 to 15 day funding on it. I'm going to update those now, right, because of this, just to give people expectations, because I know if somebody sees 10 to 15 days, what they're really seeing is 10 day funding, and then, you know, when 10 days come around, they're you know, it's just they're not happy. So I'll update those and I'll circulate that to our communications team and we'll get that out to all of the reps and update those materials. And then I would just say, as you're talking about the Express program to your borrowers, just let them know, you know, realistically due to SBA backlog, or don't even say SBA backlog, because really what it is this is, it's not even just the SBA, but due to influx of inquiries, we're looking at about 15 to 30 days, you know, for these loans to fund. So if somebody needs funds within 10 days, I would say we probably have to look elsewhere at the moment. We just want to be realistic with people. But anyways, I'm going to shut up. I'm going to let some other people ask some questions. It looks like we have a question from Karen Wharton. Hi, Karen, you've got the floor.
Hi, thank you so very much. As far as individuals who have applied and they have denied for credit, if they have not reapplied or reinstated, do you want us to start sending in a copy of their denial letter that says they were denied for credit to expedite the process? Because they will show up on their credit report that they have applied for a U.S. SBA loan or not?
So that's a good question. It will help, but when we do the eligibility, we would know if they were denied, why they were denied originally. And if it was for credit, and we know the exact credit score that was pulled at that time. So rather than, for good measure, yes, submit it with a denial letter, but I would say much more importantly, let's make sure that we actually have that that credit report with the full credit report with the current Experian score. Because that is what is pushing all of this through. It's that Experian score. So if that Experian score is below 570, then they're a good stay. That doesn't guarantee that they're going to get it, because obviously, as we all know that it depends on what FICO program or what FICO iteration that people are using. So some people might be using FICO 10, some people might be using FICO 8. I know that these particular individuals use FICO 7, so they're going off of, you know, the most generous of all of the iterations. So, but we are taking a look at it at a case by case basis in that respect.
Is there any advance as far as the forms? Is there any way there can be a line that's added for the LOs to offer up information that would help underwriting if there is a particular special case? For instance, if somebody puts in their LLC information and they have a DBA that's attached to that, some way we can put a note in that they do have a DBA and we have attached that just to minimize some of the time frame that it takes to get back in touch with the LO to find that type of information out?
Well, the way that the process will work is we do the eligibility, the eligibility is, or the processors and within Levin Capital, they take on the information and they look at the and they look at all of the documentation there, right? To make sure that we have all documentation available. Within that documentation, we should have all information regarding any DBAs, right? So yes, you have your LLC. Even if you have a DBA, it would still go off of a DBA is not going to make or break something because they're going to go off of essentially either what the main LLC has that's attached to that EIN number, right? But the first, once we have all the documents, then we do the eligibility, which is run the query of the actual credit, their social security number against what's available within the system to make sure that they did, whether or not they did or did not apply before. And if they did apply before, what was the status? Did they get it? Did they not get it? And if they didn't get it, then why they didn't get it? And it also tells us if there's already an application in the system already, right? So a lot of individuals may say, and I don't. This came up last week, right? So if I have something in already, can I withdraw the application and apply through you? I mean, the answer, the quick answer is yes. Do I want them to do it? No. The reason why is because this is a stated program, and we're basing it off of what the industry standard on as far as that is concerned. And if we already have an application in that has one set of numbers that the stated income or that the stated program is not giving, that's going to be a conflict and that's an automatic deny, right? So that's why we don't want to broach those subjects. Now, if they just didn't finish, again, it's a roll of the die. We might have somebody on the other side that is a lot more that pays attention a little more than somebody that doesn't. Because that's at the level 2 verification stage. So, but to answer your question, do you need to put whether or not it's a DBA or not to expedite underwriting? That's not whether or not there's a DBA available is not what is stopping underwriting or denying or holding up underwriting.
Thank you so much. I don't have any other questions.
Awesome. Thank you, Karen. And Tony, I have just a piggyback on you just mentioned, you know, those files that are in processing, right? Or somebody who has applied for an EIDL loan previously, and I know you and I have talked now. I think every other conversation I have with a borrower, when it comes up that they have been flagged for, you know, having already applied for an EIDL in the past, I'd say over 50% say, well, I applied 4 months ago and I never heard anything, right? So, you know, just so that everybody else kind of hears what you said, I know that we have one file with Mr. Whipple who actually withdrew, you know, his EIDL loan request in hopes to now apply for an express loan. Have we heard anything back from that particular scenario on whether or not we can now apply for an express loan?
So what we're trying to address is that if they did apply, and they still have not yet have a decision, what we would like to do is to have the opportunity to actually grab that loan. So we will need
right.
their actual confirmation number or their application ID, and then we can verify according to that application ID whether or not, you know, where they are in the system. It's been noted that at least 90% of the individuals that state that they haven't received anything have been denied. They just haven't been notified that they were denied, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's also a thing.
Sure.
We just want to make sure, you know, but we want to be sure as to what the reason for denial is. So if they do have an application in and they're wanting to, and they did apply, and they just haven't received any information, I would say for processors to then request for them to give us what the application ID for it to see if we can grab it. Are we going to be able to grab all of them? I don't think so, because they're all separate teams that are actually taking care of these. But we can give it a shot.
Sure. Okay. Well, and let me ask you this, Tony. You can verify on the first round of validation why someone was declined, right? So while we're working on processing the docs and getting them pre-screened for the next round of eligibility, are you able to, when you're cross-referencing their social and the EIN number, see why they were declined, or if it says, you know, pending application or pending review, like what, how much detail are you guys able to see?
We're able to see quite a bit, actually. We're able to see if it was applied, where are they in the application process, and if it was denied for what,
mm-hmm.
right? The denials that we're getting are not even based on those three. The denials that we're getting is because they were denied before, or they applied before and they were denied, and now they're going in and putting a different, you know, giving us different information that does not coincide with the original application.
Okay.
So they have to be really, really careful of what that information is. Now, I'm not even talking about income. I'm talking about just basic info. Where's the business? What kind of business it is, right? You know, who the owners are. So, for instance, there was a sole prop under X, Y, and Z, and then all of a sudden, you know, now someone else is applying for that same sole prop, right?
Mm.
That's not possible.
Right.
That happens. That's number one. Another one that's very, very common is you have a company that has, you know, that has multiple owners, quote unquote, or multiple shareholders. The one with the majority shareholder is the one that should be applying. But then what occurs is that then they have another borrower to apply for the same company. Well, that's cross-reference. So if we're saying that the majority shareholder was denied for whatever reason, and now the minority shareholder is applying, that is still going to get denied because now they're going to question ownership of the company. Because why is it that, so now all of a sudden this particular individual is now the majority shareholder when the owner has, when the person that's supposed to apply it has to be the majority.
Right.
So that's just the way the system works. So it has to be above 51%. If you have a 50-50, if you have a 50-50 share, I mean, it gets sticky at that point, but you really should be 51% owner.
Sure. And so I guess to bring it full circle, for those who, most of those who are in the system really have been declined for one reason or another. So if they haven't heard, it's just due to a lack of communication. But you are able to see if somebody has a pending application. And in those cases, it could be true that, you know, our borrower just hasn't received anything, that their application hasn't been processed yet. Those are the ones that we would be able to try and pick up. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Understood. And I presume that we're in our system that we use in Monday, Tony, that those will be labeled as such, as mm-hmm. you know, open application versus just duplicate file?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. All right. Very good. I want to move on because I know we have some other questions here, and one of them is from Jeffrey James in the chat, and I see he asked a while ago. Oh, and actually, he's the next person on call list, so I'll let him ask his own question here. Jeffrey, you've got the floor.
Jeffrey James, how are you guys?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. Marty, if I'm not mistaken, I sent you an email regarding the credit report service.
Yes, that is correct. Yeah, my Score IQ was having some issues pumping out reports. So I know we changed the links on the applications to the Experian, and then I received a call from our rep over at MyScoreIQ, and he told us that they had resolved the issue. So I just switched that back earlier today, actually.
Appreciate it. That was number one. Number two, I just want to say, in regards to the application, I think we should add that note that you guys said that the ownership you have to application wise that majority owner should only apply this way, adding applicants that are not the primary owner. You know what I'm saying?
It's a good suggestion. Yeah, that's a very good suggestion. I can make a note of it, and I'll put it near the borrower's information and just make it clear.
Right.
The applicant must be the majority owner in the applying business.
Yes. This way we're not having, you know, like duplicate applications coming in, you know, unknowingly. That's number one. And number three, regarding qualifying for the loan, I see the documents. I understand that. But what I don't have is what determines how much a person can apply for, because it's almost like you cannot like apply for amount if you can't qualify for amount. So it's kind of like that's not a real good application process to kind of like throw something against the wall unknowingly.
Yeah, and actually Tony probably has a good suggestion for this, but the way, because this is streamlined,
right.
You know, we are basically encouraging people to apply for max funding. If they put max funding and that's what they're looking for, it doesn't hurt them for applying for more than they'll be eligible for. Because quite frankly, well, and actually, Tony, maybe I'm going to let you take this one because you may have more details on this than I do. But that's how why we approached it that way.
So I'll ask for you to rephrase the question, because the way that I understood it is, is there a better way to apply versus just throwing something against the wall to see if it actually is approved? Am I understanding that?
Well, what's happening is if a client wants to apply for, say, $150,000, because I had the applicant gave me this, well, how can I determine if I qualify for that amount or not?
We will let them know if they're approved or not. Nothing that the borrower, I want to make, let me, okay, now that I understand fully. It's not incumbent on the borrower as how much they want or not, unless they want less than $150,000. If they only want $100,000, then that's how much they'll get. But it is determined with the Express program alone. Now, the EIDL program itself is based off of their you know, their current income. The Express program, the way that the rules are written, is specifically based off of industry standards. So depending on their industry, and that's a closely held secret, I don't even know it myself, honestly. You know, depending on the industry, this is why that industry question actually exists in the application. Depending on the industry, they're authorized. Depending on the industry and the time in business, they're authorized a specific amount for that particular industry or where they should be to avoid having to have actual underwriters underwrite this file, right? So giving the ability for the risk engine to actually be the one to drive the conversation. So as long as they answer the questions honestly with their what industry they're in and what type and what the time of business, it will spit out their max qualification. And then once we have that max, and they will know that max qualification on the verification call. The way the verification call as of right now is done is we're given a queue that we need to surmise, and then we call them on the phone, click on the queue, and it will spit out the question in order to do that verification call. If they answer correctly, it will prompt them to then go over the actual loan itself, you know, the terms of the loan itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it'll tell you how much they qualify for, how much they, you know, the max they qualify for, and what the whether or not they're going to be paying it back in 6 months or 12 months. Those are that's what's discussed on the verification call if they pass verification, right? So again, it's a closely held secret to know whether or not they're going to take the full 150 or not. But within the actual process itself, they will know how much they're actually getting. We just ask that they let us know, because regardless if they let us know. Which, Marty, honestly, I think that we can take that question out, to be honest with you. So, you know, the amount that they'd like. because when they're on the phone with the verification, with Ramir or one of the processors doing the verification, they will let them know, okay, you qualify for up to $150,000. Do you want to take the full $150,000 or not? And that will determine, you know, obviously the payment, and that will determine, obviously, you know, how soon they have to do the payback.
Okay.
So, Tony, just to be clear, because I can make some of these edits to that application. One, I like the idea of adding the applicant, you know, ownership percentage, but I'll also, you know, eliminate that. So even if somebody wants, I see what you're saying. So I can just take out that question, because I think that eliminates any questions that might arise from borrowers, similar to like who Jeffrey was speaking to, because then they're not identifying that question, and maybe that's just causing more confusion.
They'll give them more anxiety.
Yeah, right, sure. So I'll take that question out as well.
They'll give them more anxiety on that end.
It's like
an arranged marriage. You don't know what the other person looks like until the wedding night.
Right.
Can you guys still hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes.
And the reason why I say this is because I come from a world, mostly like in the government world. So when it comes down to understanding like qualifications like that, I think for the branches, we should get the branches like hyperlinks to industry information like that, because it's kind of like it's really good when we kind of like, I wouldn't say like steer our people, but give them like a best idea of what amount they should be applying for, because it gives them a better feel of like what they're getting involved with and where they may qualify. Because understand, just to throw a number out there to give people hopes on a magic number like that, I'd rather say, well, in this type of industry, we may only qualify for like this amount of money, you know, versus like a maximum. Because I feel being transparent is something that we can do, because by having that knowledge, which is really not something that's secretive, it's really a natural number, like a NASDAQ number, or a, like a, you can go through like Dun & Bradstreet, and they have like industry standards of what these fields are, so we can get that information. You know, it's just we could work together by giving the branches that like hyperlink to that information, so they can kind of like when they're talking to their client, to give them kind of like a little heads up where that kind of industry model works for them bestly, I think.
Yeah, and I think we'd all agree with that, but I think what Tony is saying is that's an insider SBA number that we don't even have, right? Like
I honestly don't think that they have it either. It's baked into the pie, right? It's built into the risk engine.
But I come from this world, and when you talk about like doing like government contracts, you can understand, you can get those numbers. We have access to those numbers, so it's not like something that can't be. I can actually give it and send it over to you, Marty.
Well, if you know the express program numbers, so I don't quite follow, because those numbers are specific to this program, right? Like it's not like an open number for like an SBA 7A. It's specific. This is the amount of qualifying funding for this type of business for the express funding program, right? So
it also has to do, that is also with the way that
it's industry standard, though.
No, it's not. It's not industry standard. That's the part that industry standard is what's giving us. The industry standard is what's giving us the amount of income that particular business with that particular time in business should be making.
I got you.
That's the industry standard. The industry standard isn't what
you're
doing is
trying to do, right? I'm sorry. What you're doing is trying to do. The industry plus the time in business. I got you now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's a couple of different things in there.
Understood.
Just push back and say, you know, even when people are trying to buy a house, they go and they find a $500,000 house, and then the mortgage office is going to run their numbers and say, nope, you don't qualify.
Understood. Mm-hmm.
You know, based off of the numbers. So, now, in that retrospect, we actually have tangible documentation, but the
right.
documentation that the risk engine is going off of is if we have a restaurant that has been in business in you know, in Detroit for the last 20 years.
Right.
Based off of that, based off of those, that criteria, you know, give or take, the industry should make X. The fact that they've been in business should be Y, and then the other thing is where they actually are, right,
got
in
it.
Detroit. So all of that together will spit out the maximum that they can actually that they can actually get.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Great questions, and I know we've got another one here right behind you. But before we move on to Shakita's question, I did just want to ask you real quick, Tony. So I think Karen Wharton had a good suggestion. That confirmation number, kind of going back to her original question earlier. If somebody has a confirmation number, can you see that confirmation number from your back end if somebody's already in there?
If I ask for it. Times out of 10, I'm not asking for it because they're just telling me, you know, it's already in process, it's already, they already applied, you know, so on and so forth. So that's, if I ask for it, yes. Am I asking for all of them? No. I'll be on the phone all the time, all day.
Yeah, of course. So this is really something that the borrower can just ask themselves,
if the borrower
right?
has access to that, to their previous, then I know how to approach it, right? So if we know, maybe that's a question, right, Marty? So then that's a logic question. Have you applied for EIDL before? Yes, right? And if they were, then, you know, was it denied? And if it or it's still in process, or I think the first question should be what was the application ID, and then ask them what the rest of it is.
Sure. Yeah, I've been wanting to add to the logic too for options for a decline as well, because right now it's pretty open ended. But all right, well I'll play with that also.
All right, Ms. Malone, I think you're up.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I just wanted to know. So I know that, you know, due to the influx of loan inquiries and things of that nature, we're looking at 15 to 30 days. Does this apply for all clients that we have put in that have either entered validation, invalidation, or already went through validation?
Great.
Yeah, I saw that question written, and I was coming up with the right answer. So rule of thumb, I don't want to commit to an actual date. I don't want to commit to an actual because we all know the borrowers, they will hold us to it, right?
Yes.
So, but however, can we say that it is, you know, 15 days from their application? I would say that from the date that they applied, we can add 30, right? From the date that they applied. I feel comfortable with that because even if we're off by a day, by you know, a day or so, you know, as long as they see that the actual file is moving forward, they'll be happy. I just don't want there, because we officially will start doing verifications again on Monday. We thought that we would be able to do it, but SBA was down today. Don't ask me why, because they didn't even explain it to us. So now they are allowing us to do the verifications as early as Monday. Between everybody in this call, we can probably do it this weekend, but I don't think that we're going to get accurate you know, responses over the weekend because they're working on a skeletons group.
Sure.
So that's why I technically don't like to do verifications on the weekend unless I have like 15 to do. But yeah, so is it from the day that they apply? I would say from the good conversation would be is from the day that you apply at 30, and then we're good.
Yeah. So the oldest file that we have so far is that's actively invalidation is 12 days from when they applied. So they're looking at another 18 days.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
To get that 30 mark. Yeah.
Okay. And the reason I asked that question is because when this thing was fresh and hot off the presses, they were really, really excited about the 10 days. So you know, from the time they get the email stating that they are entering validation, I know that they're counting down. So I just wanted to, you know, Karen and I to be prepared for that when it comes.
I would think they would be more excited about the fact that they're getting money, period.
You would think so. You would think so. But, yeah. You know.
I hear you, Shakita. And one thing that we're doing too, all the processors with this new information, we're going through all of the files that have been pre-screened and that have gone through, you know, first round of eligibility to let them all know of this update, right? So everybody's going to hear from us, whoever their processor is, letting them know, you know, of this update. So We'll take the brunt of the heat if somebody's upset about that, but there, you know, unfortunately, there's nothing that we can do about this. You know, if we were underwriting and funding all in house here, that would be a different story. You know, but since we're, you know, there is some validation with the SBA, a government entity. You know, it's impossible for us to have full control over a time frame, and so we'll just have to explain it that way. But you know, we'll take the brunt of those that are currently in process and set the expectations now for all new applicants of that time frame.
Okay, thank you, guys.
Thank you. And then I see Karen mentioned another question here. Do we need to give the applicant the NAICS code we used for their validation call? That's a good question, Tony. Do you need that? Like, does the do they need, because they're putting it on their application, right? So when they select the business entity, the NAICS code is going to be there inclusive of the entity type or the business industry that they've selected. But Tony, do they need to know that for that validation
call?
No,
because the NAICS code is not a part of the verification, at least it's not as of right now.
Okay.
And quite frankly, I doubt that they'll put it in there because NAICS codes are at very best very fluid. So I don't think that anybody is, you know, that if anybody is really holding them to it, as long as there's a good understanding of the business, then that's fine. What I want them to study up on, for lack of a better term, is what's on their credit report. So if they're pulling that credit report, I would say let's study up on it, because these questions are more and more obscure.
So Tony, can you elaborate what you mean by that? Because I think that would be good for people to know as well, as we're talking to borrowers. And most of the time, it's common sense type questions. I know one you mentioned last week was, well, the validation call said, okay, in 2018 you had a car payment. What type of car was it, right?
Right. So 90% of the questions are common sense questions. You know, what year were you born? That seems to be the standard. What year were you born in? Or what was your car payment? Or what year was this particular car? Right. People are really, really, really quick on that. The two that I think that are common, but that people are having the most issue with, is if they're associated with any other name, and that association might be, and this is how I want people to think, the association may be they were a co-borrower on something with another person. They share an address with another individual, or they went by, go by another name. Right, so something along those lines. Those are the three instances in which we're looking at that. The other one is a little more obscure, where it's what street is closest to a specific address, and that address may not be your current address. That address might be an address that you lived, you know, years ago. So that one is a little bit trickier. That tends to get people in trouble. Outside of, I can't say this over the phone with them because it's a recorded line, but I would say that they could in essence, have Google Maps up and then go through the, you know, put in that particular address and then say, you know, what mileage or how far one thing is to another. Why do they do that? Because I had this conversation with Roger the other day, and I can understand why people would be upset about it. But why would they do that? They do that because of the same situation where there's a lot of fraud on these loans, right? And the fraud that occurs on these loans is on the level of people just applying for random stuff and or people applying on behalf, not on behalf, but people going through, like, Secretary of State, Florida, we've had to shut down a couple of the Florida loans because of that. People are randomly going through the Secretary of State and then doing a quick, you know, search as to who's this, and then they apply. They apply that way. And the system is only so sophisticated to actually catch that. In Florida, for instance, you can change the individual that is on your articles of incorporation within minutes, and there's no stopping it. So imagine Marty goes on the Secretary of State and then finds, you know, the local Starbucks, and then switches the name over to himself. Now, Secretary of State also has that, all Marty needs to do is just go to the bank and open up a thing that has a DBA of Starbucks, and now he's eligible for a loan under that particular company. So here comes Starbucks behind and says, oh, you know what, I'm going to apply for this, and there's already a loan out on it. And nobody can catch that. Other than on these verification questions. And the verification questions aren't even sophisticated enough to catch the fraud against the business. They're sophisticated enough to catch the fraud against the borrower.
Good. It's all great info. Great info, Tony. I mean,
I would just put everybody, on alert that when they are doing these verification calls, like before I start recording, I let them know, just relax. They should be common sense questions, but, you know, just answer truthfully, and they shouldn't have anything to worry about. Some people are really, really quick and say, yes, this is that, and they're fine with that. I just want them to understand that there is a, you know, slight possibility that if something is wrong, it's not because anything is wrong on the credit report. It's just because they make no sense. You asked me where I lived in 1997. I know where I lived in 1997. I don't remember any cross streets. So, and those are the questions that are asked. And the safety net that we have, and I want everybody to hear this, because I hear everybody, I don't hear them, but I can understand everybody's like, oh my God, this is ridiculous, right? The safety net that we have is that because we are in real time, we'll be able to catch at least 60% of the individuals who get something wrong to try to reset it. Now, if they get one question wrong, it's easier to reset those questions in order for us to do the re-verification. If they get two questions wrong, it's not that they don't qualify. They can definitely pursue the EIDL, right? They'll just have to produce all of the documentation along with that. And then they are beholden to the max loan amount to that particular business instead of their industry. So it's not that they're saying no. They're just going to say, okay, you failed verification. Please supply 45060 and proof of all of this other stuff. And the 45060, as we all know, will download their taxes and verify, and then they'll go off of the max loan amount of that they actually did. The problem with that is that if they took a loss, they're not getting the loan.
And that kind of serves, you know, a good purpose too for everybody, by the way, because there are fees for obviously the Express loan. That's how we're getting paid. The SBA isn't paying the lender, right? So, you know, there's a give and take when somebody says, oh, well, the EIDL loan doesn't have any fees. Well, there's give and take here with that. Yeah, but the EIDL loan, take a look at your business. Yeah, exactly. It's going off of your income. You have to provide a full package for your business, your revenue, all of that, where the Express is streamlined, and that's the whole purpose of this, right? So, anyways, just wanted to make that point, because you may get that. And look, we're not here to fight borrowers either. If somebody says, 20% of my net proceeds, that's, I'm just going to go apply for an EIDL loan. Like, we're not here to fight them and say that. We're just here to explain you have your right to do that. Just please understand, here are the differences between the EIDL and the Express, and why the Express has a cost and the EIDL does not. It's more of a certainty, whereas there are certain industries I would imagine, that are ineligible for an EIDL loan, right? Right, Tony? Is that?
Yep. There are industries that won't consider that that the Express loan will.
Right, right. So they may even be in an industry that they cannot even apply for an EIDL loan. And by the way, so Tony, if somebody has started the process with us, right, and we've made it to that second round of validation, and then they decide that they want to go through an EIDL loan instead, somebody raised this question to me: are they able to do that now that we have started and have an Express loan application in the system?
So they started which process with us?
The Express loan. Let's say that we made it through, second round of validation, and then they decided, mm-hmm. I would actually prefer to do an EIDL because I don't have to pay fees, right, with an EIDL loan.
Sure.
So they could withdraw the Express at that point and still apply for an EIDL, or will it be in the system now for the EIDL with the SBA?
No, they can do it. They can do it, and then when they go do it, they can do that. And then when they go do it, it'll be flagged as a duplicate. And then the actual system will spit out something to the effect of, you've already applied, there's a duplicate account, so there, you've already applied, and we will go with the original application. And at that point, it's out of the Express hands and back in the SBA hands.
Right, sure.
And then SBA will require all the documentation.
Sure, got it. Understood. Very good. Tony, I know that we're coming up to an hour here, so we've got 11 minutes. Greg Carter just asked a question. Can a borrower who received a small EIDL loan from the SBA in May 2020 apply for the Express loan? I'll let you answer that.
The answer is no. Because if they applied for the small EIDL loan, depends on what small. Well, it doesn't even depend on what small. If they got an EIDL based off of the documentation that they submitted, and now they go to the Express loan, and now we're putting in industry standard income, that is a conflict, and they will then just deny both of them, and they probably might call back the original.
Okay.
We have seen that happen, where people don't, I don't know how they made it through the first and second level validation. They were, it was eligible, and then this was before eligibility. We started doing the eligibility standard, but they went through it, and then all of a sudden there's a duplicate application, two sets of numbers, and they called the original loan.
Wow, yeah, that's something.
There really is, and I know that we discussed this yesterday, Marty, but yeah, there really is very, very little callback features other than, and there's very little audit. The only audits that we know of as of right now is obvious audits, right? Obvious audits. So
sure.
If we're talking about two sets of numbers, all of a sudden, the money that you got should be either the money that you got as a loan should be as a Schedule C or Schedule E on your 1040s. But if you put it as a Schedule A, because you know, you decided to put it somewhere and then start charging some capital gains and whatnot, then you're good. That's a problem. Or now you have a bunch of Schedule D because you took the money and you started buying stocks because the stock market is amazing. Well, now you've got some splitting to do. So those are the obvious. So if you keep in line where you were doing Schedule C before and you continue doing Schedule C now, or you were doing Schedule E before and you continue doing Schedule E now, you should be marked. It won't trigger anything. But if there's an obvious increase in your lifestyle, that's a thing.
Understood. Good deal.
Any questions?
All right. Doesn't look like it, Tony. So I guess just to wrap it up, to kind of bring it full circle for everybody in regards to pipeline, we're going to be resuming those validation calls on Monday. Tony, does that include the first round of validation or the second round of the actual phone calls?
All of them. We go with the first come, first curve. So wherever we left off, that's where we're gonna
Okay, right. But I guess what I was actually referring to is the eligibility validation, right? That starts from
the eligibility is still going. We never stopped that. That never stopped. The eligibility one was never that never stopped. When it's in verification that it got held up because on the eligibility question they were noticing, you know, when we submitted over with the IP, that's when they were, you know,
sure. You know, getting right. Started. Right. Yeah. The SBA validation. Okay. So those that when we fixed or corrected that that sheet yesterday, those have started going through that eligibility.
Through eligibility. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Got it. Okay. Wonderful. All right, guys. Last chance to ask any questions here regarding the Express. We've got 7 minutes till we hit an hour. Does anybody else have anything to chime in? All right, good deal. Well, with that being said, then you know, everybody stay safe this weekend. We'll be back in touch with everybody on Monday. Like I mentioned, the processors will reach out to all of the files that we have to give, you know, the updated time frames on these loans so that they have those expectations there. If you guys have any questions on the program, you can email into businessloans@11capitalfinance.com. That's how you get over a hold of Tony here. And yeah, I'll get some updates onto the application here and appreciate everyone jumping on.
All right. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tony.